listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past February marked the 150th anniversary of the birth of W.E.B. Du Bois, the American sociologist, historian, human rights activist, Pan-Africanist author, writer, and editor. Among his massive body of work, The Philadelphia Negro, published in 1899 while he was teaching at Atlanta University. That seminal work was a sociological study of African Americans in Philadelphia. It was the first sociological case study of a black community in the United States and one of the earliest examples of sociology as a statistically based social science. At the Philadelphia Saturday Free School, Professor Tony Montero has organized over the course of the year a series of events entitled collectively The Year of Du Bois. On November 8th and 9th in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Saturday Free School will host The Black Worker in Our Time, an Indispensable Force for Peace and Justice. We spoke with Professor Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Friday.
This next week on November 8th and 9th here in Philadelphia at the union headquarters of 1199C of the Hospital Workers Union here in Philadelphia, we will be holding a two-day symposium on the black worker in our time. In fact, the symposium is entitled The Black Worker in Our Time, an Indispensable Force for Peace and Justice. And on November 8th, we're going to start with a kind of panel that looks at the role of Paul Robeson and Martin Luther King in the fight for labor and how both of them linked the struggle of labor to the black worker and to the overall struggle for peace and justice. And that'll start at 5 o'clock and we'll go to 9 o'clock. We'll look at some documentary films, and then we'll have a panel consisting of Henry Nicholas, the president of 1199 here in Philadelphia, and Jed Dodd, the vice president of the Railroad Maintenance Workers Union, which is a division of the Teamsters Union, and Catherine Blunt, who is a longtime rank-and-file activist in the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and a fighter for peace and justice. And then on Friday, the 9th of November, starting again at 5 o'clock, we'll have two panels, one which will be devoted to looking at the book that was published in 1973, written by Henry Winston, called Strategy for a Black Agenda, which places the question of Black labor within the framework of both the Pan-African movement and the international working class movement. And then following that, we're going to have a panel on the struggle of the working class and the fight for peace, which will be honored to have you, Don DeBar, as one of the panelists. So that's what we will be doing. And we think it's very important, given that it will come 2 days after probably the most important midterm election in maybe the nation's history, an election that will impact not just this nation and its politics going forward, and even if we are to have politics going forward, but the world will be looking at this midterm election because it will impact greatly many of the questions that we're going to be looking at this conference, including the struggle for peace, the struggle for international justice, and for the world's working class.
So, in the, by the way, there's a companion piece at Black Agenda Report that I recommend, The Black Worker in Our Time, an Indispensable Force for Peace and Justice, the title of the conference, Philadelphia Saturday Free School. Before you tell us about the free school, because our audience, you know, they've heard once or twice, but a lot of people haven't heard this at all. You say that you're taking a Du Boisian approach. We're talking, yes, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois. Could you elaborate on that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, well, this is very important, I think, because Du Bois, although it's not really recognized, is a major theorist of the fight for peace, the global fight for peace and of the working class. And he begins with the world's majority, the colonized and neo-colonized workers of Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, and South America. And he gives a different kind of look at what we call international solidarity or working class internationalism, and he links it in ways that are very contemporary to the fight for peace and against nuclear weapons, and of course, the ongoing fight to break the hold of Western imperialism and finance capital over nations and the labor of the nations of what we sometimes call the Third World. But then, you know, we're looking at some synthesis here, because one cannot talk about the struggle against imperialism without at the same time talking about Lenin's work and Henry Winston's work in the mid-1970s, kind of work towards a synthesis of Du Bois and Lenin. Du Bois's concept of the workers of the darker nations and Lenin's concept of imperialism as the highest stage of crisis of imperialism. And we very much agree. In fact, in the call to the conference, we call the era of Trump the era of the total crisis of imperialism, which in our minds suggests that we're on the cusp of a great epical change. We might, as we would see it, be in a moment of transition from one epoch to another. So we think this kind of discussion is highly significant in the times in which we live.
You know, inside the development of Marxism, there's been this tension almost from the beginning of the practical application of it at the beginning of the 20th century, I guess, between those that looked at, we're going to expect revolution in the most advanced countries, and those that saw the revolutionary potential in the countryside, you know, in the peasantry, in the exploited around the world, as opposed to the exploited industrial workers in the advanced countries. That was a strategy that was used, and this was a breaking point, for example, between Lenin and Trotsky and others in the Soviet Union in Russia, where they built the alliance of workers and peasants that ended up successfully installing there. The Marx, Engels, even to a degree at the beginning, Lenin, begin maybe in the factory or the city or the nation state, and then look, you know, a sort of unpack a global system from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. And Du Bois, if I understand it correctly, is looking at it as an entire, you know, as a whole, and looking at the class dynamics across the planet, across a planetary system, ab initio almost. And so maybe you could talk about how all of that plays out, and also correct me where I have this wrong, because it's something that I've studied, but I don't really, believe me, I'm no expert.
Yeah, that's very important, the question that you raise. And this is where the understanding of the black worker in the United States is so important, because Du Bois saw the black worker as connected to the overall working class in the United States, but because of racial oppression and what is something very similar to colonial and national oppression, the black worker sees herself and himself in a wider world context than the white worker generally does in the United States. And of course, being captured and enslaved in Africa and brought to this country, you know, black workers and black people always have a sense of themselves as part of Africa and hence Asia. So it is not, I don't think the Du Boisian concept is third worldism in that sense, but it does look at the world from the standpoint of the global majority. And I think if we look at places such as China or India or Vietnam or South Africa or Nigeria or Kenya or Egypt, we have seen over the last 70 years the period of the anti-colonial and anti-neo-colonial struggles, the maturation of the working classes and working masses of those countries. I would suggest, for example, that China will not go forward. And we cannot imagine China in the 21st century without talking about a class conflict within China, within the Communist Party of China, as workers working in state-run enterprises as well as foreign corporations fight for their rights as China becomes, again, this not just a developing or emerging nation or market, but a major player. In fact, the world's largest economy. The same thing would be the case in India. And certainly, one cannot talk for a minute about South Africa without talking about the maturing and coming to the fore of politics and economics in South Africa of the South African working class. Similarly in Nigeria, and we can go on in Brazil, in Chile, in Venezuela, and so on and so forth. So we see the maturation of the working classes of the what Du Bois called the darker nations. And this is not what some years ago people would call third worldism, because we do not think of these workers as a part of a third world and the working classes in the so-called developing countries as a first world. We don't look at things first and third in that sense.
Right.
We look at it from the standpoint of where is the principal agency of radical and indeed revolutionary change located?
Right, right. I mean, if that's the question, then that's what you're looking for. And it seems
yes.
History put that question on the stage a while ago now.
Yes.
You know, the struggle with China, for example, the class. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, as long as there are classes, we've known this from Marx, as long as there are classes, there's class struggle. I mean, that's
right.
the point of creating classes, and classes actually get created in response to events, but the point of creating them is for one group of people to oppress another. They're usually the ones that create it. You know, there's definitely, whatever you characterize the Chinese nation state or political economy as, capitalist, socialist, mixed, whatever, certainly there are multiple classes operating within the economy and therefore the body politic. If you look at the maneuvering that's been going on with Trump particularly, but with the U.S. generally as against China in that context, what are some of the things that you see?
Well, first of all, you know, we too often in the West or in the United States talk about what Trump is doing. I think we have to also take into account what is happening in China and some of the changes since the 19th Party Congress and the establishment of what they call the thought of Xi Jinping. I think what this represents is a gradual change away from the privileging of Chinese and foreign capital over the interest of the working class. How this will play out, I don't think anyone really knows, because China is a very complicated situation at this time. I think that the policies of Donald Trump may play a positive role in forcing the Chinese leadership to rethink its domestic economy, and in so doing, to have to rethink whether or not they will remain what they call a state capitalist society, or move quickly towards socialism. Now, of course, to achieve this in China will carry with it a profound political and ideological struggle. And things politically are going to be radically different at the end of the day. But I think much of this will orient upon the Chinese working class and peasantry.
You know, there are two novelties in that struggle, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's taken place before in the Soviet Union elsewhere.
Right.
But this time, you know, the prize is arguably the world's largest economy, and certainly 10, 20 years from now, you know, by far, maybe by an order of magnitude, given the potentiality. So that's what's being fought over. And, you know, that's different. That was never the case before in history. And it also comes within the context of the rising expectations of, you know, hundreds of millions of people in China who have been elevated from poverty over the last, say, 15 years into, you know, a rather comfortable life, certainly a much improved life. In addition to that, it's never happened where This was a non-European power at the pinnacle of this, or at the object of this. China's emergence as whatever it becomes, right, it's also going to be the first non-European, non-Caucasian largest economy in the world for the first time. That's what's being fought over, and the implications of that for everything, for global white supremacy, for global capitalism, for the capitalism that's owned by the six guys in a basement in wherever. You know, it's a huge change. It's the first time that this moment has come.
Well, I just like to correct you. This will not be the first time in history that an Asian nation will be the preeminent economic force or power in the world. If you go back 250, 300 years ago,
right,
before the rise of Europe,
agreed,
China was that nation.
Agreed. You didn't have quite the same global system. That's what I'm talking about. This is going to be,
absolutely,
this is who's, you know, potentially in charge of the world after this.
And this raised a lot of questions, not just for China, but for Asia, for Korea and the uniting of Korea. What will that look like for Vietnam? And of course, I think so much will be determined by what ideology and worldview guides the Chinese leadership. And that will determine its relationships with its neighbors, and in particular, its largest neighbor, India.
Right.
Whether China will pursue hegemonist foreign policies. What will China look like in Africa? Let's be real.
Right.
China doesn't have a lot of resources. Africa has an abundance of resources. Will the Chinese go there and operate as colonialists or neo-colonialists? Or will they go and understand that we're not talking about China of the ancient world, the Middle Kingdom, the center of the world, as it were, but China as part of a new world system, a new world of peace and justice? These are huge questions. I cannot say what the mindset of the Chinese leadership is at this time. I can say that this long period of almost 40 years of out-and-out cooperation, and I would think it's sometimes subservience to U.S. foreign policy in the interest of China's, quote, economic development, I think that's coming to an end. But what will China become in terms of the world itself? And this is huge.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you talk about the implications, for example, for Africa. You know, China's building out or trying to build out the String of Pearls, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's a competitor, quote unquote, in Africa with the West.
Right.
Kind of maybe inadequate language for the actual nature of the relationships, but you know, striving, you know, China's doing business deals, displacing deals that might be imposed by the West. Otherwise, they're offering alternatives, which, you know, is an interesting dynamic also. And what model of, you know, relations will China have? As you said, will it be neocolonialism? Will it be fraternal, but China is the big brother to the little brother Africa? Will
right.
it be actual win-win, we're developing the world as a whole, as many, you know, people that defend China say is the, you know, and that's the avowed purpose of what they're doing from the CPC. All of those things, and of course you look at Latin America the same. I mean, China is heavily invested there already, and you know, we don't know what this election in Brazil is going to mean, but you know, they're talking about building a transcontinental railroad in South America and a canal in Nicaragua and deep water ports up and down both coasts of South and Central America and Cuba. Same throughout Asia, you know, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, all these other, you know, groupings and the relations between Korea, Japan, all of this is, so is China going to relate to them on a peer-to-peer basis and develop the part of the world that falls out of the hands of the United States, or are they going to pursue some other thing, I think? So,
yeah.
All right, let's go back to, and we're going, I think, too deep into this, and let's go back to Philadelphia, where we have this coming weekend, that's going to be the weekend of the 9th, what have we got, the 8th and the 9th, is that the...
By the way, it's not a weekend, it's on a Thursday.
Thursday and Friday. So it's late next week. So we've got on Thursday, Robeson and Martin Luther King, the labor movement, the fight for peace. And on Friday, and a panel discussion. And then on Friday, Winston's strategy for a black agenda, the black worker in the time of Trump. And also, after a video interlude, agenda for a positive peace in time of imperial retreat. The vision forward for the black worker and humanity. You've been discussing this imperial retreat for years now. Maybe you could work that a little bit and tie that into what we've been discussing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, there's an article in the journal National Interest by a retired Army colonel. His last name is McGregor. And I forget the title of the article, but it's in one of the recent editions of this journal, where this Army colonel argues that Trump's policies represent, he didn't use the word imperial retreat, I think he uses the words empire retreat or breakup of the empire. And this is what is happening. But I think Trump recognizes what anybody with a little bit of sense knows, that the this vast U.S. military and economic empire was impoverishing the United States. And this is what we're looking at. I think that the era of Trump is not the era of the onset of fascism. I think the fascists have been in power for some 70 years.
Yeah, really.
But it is the onset of a new stage of an existential crisis of American imperialism. You know, we see all the signs of it politically, even in the behavior of the stock markets and Trump's maneuvering. We hear today that the stock markets are up because Trump and Xi Jinping had a pleasant phone conversation on Thursday. So I would say, yes, we're in a period of imperial retreat, but imperial retreat occasioned by a new stage of crisis in the world imperialist-dominated system.
Yeah, you're talking about a piece, Douglas McGregor, The Only Way Donald Trump Can Truly Put America First. And yes, exactly. It says Trump's been wanting to disengage U.S. forces from overseas commitments where there's no direct relation to national security. And people need to keep in mind, we have some 800 to it. I've seen so many different counts, hundreds and hundreds, up to maybe 1,000 or 1,500 military bases around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Largest consumer of fossil fuels in the world, the U.S. military.
Yes, yes. And you know, if you read Bob Woodward's book, I've mentioned this before, the real struggle within the White House and the what he calls chaos there was over Trump's fighting with his advisors and cabinet members over the question of imperial retreat, where Mattis and Tillerson and McMaster and others are constantly saying to him, no, you're wrong. You don't understand what a military retreat from Korea would mean in terms of, quote, our security.
Right.
And he is saying, no, we have to get out of there. We can't afford it. And this is the case all over the world. Even his position on trade surpluses, where he is arguing they're not good for the nation, they're bad for the American working class, and so on. And the Goldman Sachs people are arguing the opposite. The whole book is pretty much 90% about Trump and his positions on foreign policy and American empire. And this article by Douglas McGregor kind of confirms what we have been saying, the Gareth Porter argument, the same thing. Right. I mentioned a few months ago an article in the Washington Times detailing the internal debates and Trump's argument that every military engagement, including Afghanistan and Syria and Korea, had to be justified, or else he was cutting back. Or as McGregor points out in this recent article, that after 2 years of military budget increases, now Trump is calling for a major cutback in military spending.
Yeah, enabled politically by the big boost at the head end of it. You know, right. We've only got about a minute and a half left, but I just wanted to say, look, reading McGregor's article and looking at TV today, the huge irony that if you think about imperial retreat to its logical conclusion, you bring the U.S. military back inside the country, and it goes into a posture like the military of every other country in the world, and that is defending only one place, its borders.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right.
He's saying this is where the military belongs, yeah, at the borders and nowhere else.
That's right. And this is why this 2018 election is the most consequential, probably not just midterm, but one of the most consequential elections in the nation's history. Now, it could end being indecisive. Nothing is changed radically. And therefore, it would be the beginning of the 2020 battle, which is a big ideological and political struggle about the future and direction of the nation. And what we're trying to do with this symposium is re-anchor and reorient the left, or to rebuild a left built upon clear thinking, empirical evidence, and a vision of the future.
Wouldn't that be a change? Thank you very much, Professor Montero. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Maybe, just maybe, there is some hope for Yemen. And globalists suffer a major defeat in Brazil. And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Arthur Demchuk. He is the deputy dean at the Department of Political Science at Moscow State University. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Mark, let me go to you first here. We have announcements, proclamations coming from the United States, from the State Department to the Defense Department about Yemen, about calling for a ceasefire within 30 days, get some movement on that. Does that story have any legs at all? Because the Saudis and others in the region have not really officially reacted.
Peter, don't you think it's time to move on from this story? Obviously, we're spending far more time than the Western mainstream media is. You keep
but that's why. But that's why I harp on it, because somebody's got to harp on it.
Yeah, I don't expect anything to come from this. First of all, the most restrained voice in Yemen among the government, and it must be said, the larger blob on the right or left, is James Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. And he is the most restrained voice in the administration, which is probably why he's been slated to likely be removed from office after the midterms, with Trump saying he's kind of a Democrat and talking about him leaving. It's not written on the wall yet, but Maybe it is.
Well, I guess talking about Yemen is akin to talking to about Khashoggi, Dima, because that seems to be disappearing too. It will take weeks to determine what kind of sanctions will be. Although, how many news cycles is that? I think it will all be forgotten intentionally.
Well, if we look at the Khashoggi case, right now the Western media is concentrated on how everyone reacts to it now. In reality, I think we should look at the past. Who supported Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia during the last 5 or 6 years?
Who didn't?
Was, in fact, Russia didn't. Iran didn't. Hezbollah didn't. Who supported Mohammed bin Salman? It was the United States.
Israel.
It was Israel. It was basically, all in all, the European Union. They supported his stance on Assad 100%. They supported his action in Yemen 100% when it started in August 2014. Let me bring you back to August 2014. First, the Western world was expecting that the Ukrainian army would finally crush, you know, that rebellion, as they called it, in the east of Ukraine. Although the real rebellion happened several months before that in Kyiv with 35 policemen killed. I wonder how the American media would describe a peaceful demonstration killing 35 policemen in Washington, right?
Well, but that's why they have the mainstream media.
Yeah. So they expected a victory in Ukraine, and they expected a quick victory in Yemen. And look how they reacted to the fact that Russia took a neutral stand at the time and didn't support. They said that Russia isolated itself by this action even more than it isolated itself by not supporting the joint Western and Arab League action against Mr. Assad.
And who said that?
It was basically one of the editorials in the New York Times.
New York Times.
And it was the general trend. You know, if you look at the media in Europe, in the United States, it was basically saying the same thing. If everyone goes against Yemen, let me remind you, Egypt went against Yemen. Even Pakistan went against Yemen. If everyone goes against Yemen, then Yemen is probably wrong. Well, it's the same thing with Syria. You know, when the whole class attacks one boy, usually it's the one boy who is right and not the whole class.
It seems to me that this tells us very clearly that the United States is not willing to restrain the Saudis and their allies and their war against Yemen. I mean, even it hardly got into the news until the Khashoggi affair, and now people know about it. There's still no real push to end this senseless war.
Well, first, I think that the United States took a very convenient position on Khashoggi affair. On the one hand, it's not possible to cancel all the contracts. So the idea of the American administration is just to determine who is personally responsible for that. So
the relationship, so the Saudi relationship trumps any kind of personal responsibility for committing premeditated murder.
Yes, sure. So it's not to blame the whole country, the leadership, but just to trace and punish only those who are responsible.
Then it would be the House of Saud.
We're talking about an absolutist dictatorship.
It's 15 people. The same magic figure as with 9/11. 15 Saudis took part in it.
Yeah,
of course, Saudi Arabia was not punished.
Now that's deep analysis there. All right, I want to switch gears here. The tropical Trump. What's going on in Brazil? Because I think Western media is misunderstanding fundamentally what is going on in Brazil and what happened with the electorate. And what I mean by saying that is, if you look at the coverage, it's basically blaming the people, the way they voted. It's an echo of how liberal media looks at American politics. It's the deplorables' fault, okay? I think that's a misreading of what's going on here in Brazil.
So we had an extreme right wing, what is often described as populist, I would rather refer to as fascist, leader be, for the most part, freely elected.
Are the people fascist then?
Some of them,
But 55%?
30% of the British, of the Brazilian electorate, and they are required to vote, either annulled or marked down their ballots. They chose not to vote. And actually, I think the big reading of this, right, you had a leftist candidate, like the last few governments have been. Lula da Silva was not allowed to run. He was jailed on politically motivated corruption parties. Then the judge who jailed him was immediately given a position in Bolsonaro's new administration. I think this is a failure of the, quote, liberal Democrats.
Of course. That's what I think, too.
Because they were so threatened by left-wing governments that redistributed wealth to Brazil's very large impoverished population, education, health programs, etc., that they chose either not to vote or they voted for the law and the one promising brutal law and order. And I mean,
well, it has one of the highest homicide rates in the world.
It does. But it's going to have a higher because this one says he's going to give police freedom to kill and that a policeman who doesn't kill isn't a policeman.
Okay, Dima, okay. What's really interesting here is that I think the Western liberals, they see what's going on in Brazil through the prism of contemporary politics in the West.
And
I
mean,
this president-elect, he is fighting the battle of the 60s and the 70s. He was part of the junta in Brazil. This is
the U.S.-supported fascist dictatorship
exactly.
in Brazil.
I mean, this is almost like a time capsule, in a way, if you look at the rhetoric of Brazilian politics. It's almost a reflection of the battles that they fought then. Go ahead.
Well, if you look at the way the American media reacts to elections in Latin America, they're never happy. The Latin Americans always get it wrong.
Don't you remember the day? I'm the oldest here. I remember just have democracy and let people vote. They did that. Then they started voting to the left. Oh, now we have to get rid of these regimes here. This is a pattern.
Let me just give you the headline in New York Times. Can Brazilian democracy be saved? Well, my question is, what is your business about saving democracy in Brazil? You already saved democracy in Chile in 1973. You already saved democracy in Brazil in 1964, supporting basically a coup against the then Brazilian President Goulart, whom they accused of being in cahoots with communist Moscow. Well, my understanding...
And don't forget Honduras.
Exactly, okay. And Honduras and Guatemala. I'm not going to talk about that. But my understanding is that people in Latin America are fed up with the so-called mainstream liberal politics. And they tried to get out of the mainstream. They voted for Chavez in 1999 because they were fed up with that oil company PDVSA, you know, giving billions to the United States and their company, and giving millions to Venezuela and its people, you know. So, Obama and others were not happy with Chavez, and now they're not happy with
Maduro. They're never happy
with Bolsonaro now in Brazil. And the problem is that the mainstream doesn't work.
This is a failure of the establishment here. It's really interesting, as Mark already alluded to. And I mean, if you look ever since democracy came to Brazil, it has essentially been a left to center, very solid left to center. What happened here? 55%. And you have evangelicals playing a very important role here. I mean, the message was very, very different than what was being reported in Western media here. Of course, we heard, you know, less than sterling narratives about politics. I mean, this president-elect, he's a bit vulgar. I guess that's why he's called the Tropical Trump here. But this is a radical message from the vast majority of the people to the elites.
Exactly. I think that the presidential election in Brazil, they reflect the general trend that people in general are tired of the old elite and the old model of governance. So there is a demand for elite change. And Bolsonaro very successfully found its own role. And his very radical statements may be just for PR to get more publicity. I don't think he will introduce similar methods.
But you think essentially that the law and order, anti-corruption rhetoric, because you hear all these other vulgar things, people are filtering that out because what they want is someone that's going to speak directly to their concerns.
Yes, exactly. It reminds me of one survey, a public opinion poll that was done in Brazil in mid-80s. And I think American scientists who were there, they were shocked by the results. More than 60% of Brazilians, they may be asked to several thousand people, they said they could vote for any government, be it fascist or be it a new emperor or communists or Democrats, on the condition that this government solves two major problems of Brazil: eradicate poverty and combat crime.
Hold that thought. We're going to go to a short break here. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
Perfect.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Mark here. Let's look if there is a trend, some tendencies here. And let's take a look at Brexit, Trump, Hungary, Germany, Brazil. Is there a thread that ties them all together?
No.
Okay.
No, I think too much can be made. I think this Brazil is a particular situation that has a lot to do with Brazil's history of dictatorship and the history of U.S.-backed military dictatorship throughout South America.
That's a theme that doesn't get the mainstream at all.
Okay, so this is a leader who has said that openly, many times, he supports dictatorship. He wants to turn Brazil into a dictatorship.
A former congressman himself.
He said he is an admirer of Pinochet and wants to bring Pinochet neoliberal shock therapy economics to the country. He says the problem with the previous Brazilian U.S.-backed dictatorship is that it imprisoned too many people and didn't kill enough. We need to kill at least 30,000. He wanted to start a civil war and kill 30,000 back in the 90s. He's torture. He's all in favor of it. He thinks it's great. The indigenous, they're parasites. We have to get rid of all the native reserves and so on.
He got 55% of the vote.
He got 55% of the vote when 30% of the population didn't even vote. And the principal leftist candidate, whom every polls agreed would have won, was jailed on politically motivated corruption charges right before the election. I don't see him as a populist in the brand of Trump.
I agree.
This is all the character that they make out of Trump in the liberal media in the U.S., this man actually represents. And it is completely wrong that in the U.S. they don't support him. The U.S. administration is crowing about his election.
Well, Wall Street liked him, too.
Wall Street likes him. Israel, he already announced he's going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. And BRICS is dead as an organization with this. He's going to move Brazil so far into the U.S. camp. Right now, the biggest thing they're talking about in the U.S. neocon circles, I'm looking at former Admiral Stavridis writing in Bloomberg, talking about the sweep of victory of the U.S.
Bolton's
across
new
all
axis.
South America. It's not a coincidence that John Bolton, U.S. National Security Advisor, referred to a new troika of tyranny and a triangle of terrorism, talking about Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain. No. That was Nicaragua, Honduras. Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. Honduras has already been overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup.
Let me go to Dima here. I mean, there are people that like to use the example of Germany and Brazil as part of this populist wave. And I agree with Mark. Populism is a more of a strategy and not an ideology. And I think we should do a separate program on that. Mark says there's not enough to tie them together. What's your take?
Well, first, about Bolsonaro, I think we just don't know. I mean, a lot of horrible things were said about the Filipino president Duterte because of his way of fighting the drug problem. Well, the United States and their friends in Mexico killed 45,000 people during this war on drugs. That is a fact. And that is a lot more than Duterte is accused of killing in the Philippines. So I think we just don't know. We have to see how he will act and what will happen. Because I'm kind of tired of the United States saying, you know, Saddam Hussein is going to wage a war on all of the Middle East. Gaddafi is going to attack Europe by terrorist acts. Maduro is going to attack Colombia. And then we have the United States and the European Union attacking Iraq. And then we have Sarkozy starting to bomb Libya. So the so-called moderate guys, the mainstream guys, are more cruel, in fact.
Yeah, I don't think we have to worry about this because he's an entirely pro-U.S. candidate supported by U.S.
military.
We
still have to see. Okay, we'll see. About Germany. I think we should congratulate the world with the fact that Merkel is leaving after basically losing the election in Hessen. The problem with Merkel is that she is very politically correct. She would not say things like the ones that Bolsonaro said. But she started the coup in Ukraine. She supported Klitschko in person. Her foreign minister was speaking to the peaceful protesters in Maidan who killed 35 policemen.
Interesting.
She compared the division, the so-called division between Crimea and Ukraine to the division of Germany. This was all lies.
It's very interesting because, you know, if you look back at 2014, that was one of the first major foreign policy initiatives that the Europeans had under the helmshed of Angela Merkel, and it was an utter catastrophe here.
Absolutely.
Okay, gentlemen, I want to move on here. Let's talk about it's time for sanctioning of Iran here. I think that if this was done 15 or 20 years ago, there might be something to it. But I think that there's going to be an enormous amount. There already rhetorically is a lot of pushback against the Trump administration for its attempted global sanctioning of Iran. It isn't going to happen. And allied relationships already under stress are going to be under even more stress. Iran is going to wait this and win this out, Otto.
I would compare the decision about sanctions against Iran with the very recent decision to withdraw from this very good old treaty between
INF treaty,
yes. And I think that the idea of President Trump and his administration is first to free their own hands. Mm. So they're no longer committed to some deals that were made by their predecessors. So they are not responsible for the policies of Obama or the previous presidents. So it makes them gives them more freedom of choice about their future moves. And also, I think for Trump, it's very important to seize the initiative, not be the follower of the previous leaders, but to lead, not to follow. So
that's a policy of spite, it seems to me. Anything that Obama did, it has to be undone here.
But
I think also that you have, again, we've talked many, many times. I've actually made separate programs on the hand of John Bolton here. This is the next step right here, and the threatening of allies here. Yeah. This is going to be, Iran is going to draw very specific lines in the sand. I think this is a very important story here, Mark.
Yeah, I, first of all, we have to remember we have an administration that the foreign policy at this point is now entirely in the hands of the neocons, John Bolton, Pompeo, and you know, they have a hard-on for war with Iran. I mean, that's exactly, when you talk the understatement of freedom of options, that's exactly what we're talking about, is they're moving step by step, part of a you could see the scripted phases towards a war of aggression against Iran, whether that's a Libya style, supporting proxies or so on. I think that's the most likely case, maybe some limited strikes, but that's what we are going to. But these sanctions are a joke.
Yes.
I mean, did you see the advertisements? I mean, they ran advertisements for sanctions like Trump thinks he's George R. R. Martin. Sanctions are coming instead of winter is coming. These are the list of countries that the U.S. has already granted waivers to because they already announced they're not going to follow
the
sanctions.
So what's the greatest hits?
China. The biggest economy in the world.
India, the second
most populous country in the world. Taiwan, all right, U.S. ally and little client state off the coast of China. South Korea. U.S. ally, Italy, part of the EU, the United Arab Emirates, U.S. ally dictatorship in the Middle East, Turkey, a nominally still part of NATO, kind of U.S. ally that the U.S. can't afford to make any angrier right now because their proxies are killing each other in Syria. And Japan, a major industrial company and U.S. ally.
So Iraq didn't make the cut?
Iraq as well. And they've been granted not only oil, but for food and other things as well. So before the sanctions are even come into effect, they've already been granted waiver. And the rest of the EU is certainly not going to follow suit either. So sanctions are coming. Sanctions already left, and they didn't happen.
Okay, well, Dima, I'm going to use an American idiom here. I hope you catch it here. But it's all hat and no cattle. Okay.
Absolutely.
Did they really say that?
Yeah. I heard that. I heard that on a podcast. I just loved it.
the point with Iran is that if the United States and the European Union, if you look at the recent years, the only country that openly said that Mohammed bin Salman was a killer and that openly opposed his actions was Iran. Not even Russia. Mm-hmm. Even Russia didn't do it. So when they say now, oh, sanction Iran, oh, you know, crippling sanctions out of hell, I think they are trying to sanction their own conscience because the Iranians were the only ones who saw the real cure and actually counteracted him.
And not only those eight countries are an exception. Even American companies may get special license from the Treasury Department and do business with Iran if needed. So it's like sanctions are sanctions, but you can always get.
Mark, is this again Trump pulling out that envelope where he has all of his promises on the back and he just checks it off? It seems to me very rhetorical here.
Yeah, this is obviously a political move before the elections to a large extent. I'm not so sure how popular sanctions on Iran are with the American people.
They're not, actually.
I don't think American people care about sanctions on Iran. I mean, either way, I don't think they don't support them. I don't think they do support. I don't think they really care about that. It's not what Americans vote or care about. Other than from the angry comments, the people that watch the show, you all know that you are not the average Americans, that you actually are concerned with foreign
because
policy.
Because you wouldn't be watching this program.
You wouldn't be watching the show if you are, right? But by and large, you know, every data shows Americans do not vote on foreign policy, and they certainly don't care whether there's sanctions or not on Iran.
Last 30 seconds go to you, Dima.
Well, there was one more story that happened. Obviously, the Ukrainian church is going to face some very difficult times ahead. The President Poroshenko came to Istanbul, to Constantinople. He signed a deal with the Patriarch of Constantinople, and the U.S. State Department supported this. So much for the wall of separation between church and state. We have the guy who came to power in Ukraine via a violent coup meeting the head of a religious organization that represents 8,000 people living in Istanbul, and they both decide to crush, basically, a church which is about 1,000 years old and which catered to the Orthodox believers.
Okay, Dima, we're going to ask you to keep an eye on that story. We'll come back to you with it in the future. That's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.